Thank you very much for the invitation to talk today. Before I start my presentation, I thought I would reprieve one of the little activities that we did this morning as an audience, which was to put up our hand if we knew a particular group. I'd like you to put up your hand, please, if you have spent more than 2 hours and know the first and last name of somebody who earns less than $2 a day. Okay, that's interesting, because there's more people, for example, than there were people who knew the travellers. Okay, so my presentation is very much about the colonial present. I want to jump over some of the sort of geographical historical work that I've done on understanding why colonial legacies are so important in Latin America, and really focus on the patterns of inequality that those colonial legacies have left, both at the global scale and also within Latin American countries. And the perspective I take then is to try and look at, through ethnographic work, some of the ways in which inequality is experienced. But first of all, I want to take you through unpacking some of the global patterns of inequality that we find, and in relation to which the British context, of course, comes out looking very different if one puts oneself within that broader context. So the inequality between nations has often been measured in terms of gross national income per capita. And here we can see the wealthier countries appearing in green and the poorer countries appearing in various shades of red. Within that, the inequality by concentrations of population on less than $2 a day is shown here. The darker red, the higher the level of numbers of people on that under that income band, which is rather an arbitrary one, but it is a very important reminder of the geographical inequality of or the distribution of inequality. And then we have the Gini coefficient, which Vince Cable was talking about before. And again, the darker red indicates the higher degrees of inequality. So this is very important because it starts to show that countries which might be middle income, such as in Latin America or China or India, have also within them very high levels of inequality. So in this context, one can ask, well, what are the policy measures, or what are the ways in which these kinds of forms of inequality are being addressed? And I don't want to go through very much detail on this, but I wanted to put the Millennium Development Goals and what have now become through as the Sustainable Development Goals in a bit of a broader context. So we, first of all, have to recognize that over the last sort of 20 years or so, foreign direct investment in other countries has often outstripped the investment or the transfer of overseas development aid, particularly by the DAC donors. And that amount of development aid is often just about equal to or slightly higher than the remittance flows between migrant workers and their home countries. So we have very important and differently geographically configured patterns of flow and patterns of globalization and patterns of policy intervention within many different countries of the global south. We also have to recognize that ODA is increasingly selective and conditional, and so it is not reaching all parts of the world, and the pattern of aid is also often used in a performance by wealthy countries to say that they're helping countries, and then sometimes the cash doesn't follow through. So there is also a performative element on that. So there is, perhaps counterintuitively, a sort of cyclical shift away from aid towards sub-Saharan African countries, even though that region is often highly dependent upon aid for its income. And the reasons for these different geographical patterns are, of course, very difficult to unpack. But I thought I would just highlight the sort of, you know, the legacies of colonialism in the way that we think about distant strangers and our commitment to them, and raise the issue particularly of the different per capita distribution of aid by countries. And here you see that countries that are more equal in Europe are also often the ones that are giving the highest per capita aid to other countries. I mean, the exception being perhaps Finland. The tsunami in 2005 was very interesting in terms of it's showing up some of these inequalities in support being given by different countries. We can also look at the aid budgets in relation to military spending, which is quite an interesting comparison to be made as well. But this leads me then to the major kind of headline program, which was dealing with inequality from 2000 until 2015, which were the Millennium Development Goals. And the Millennium Development Goals had a number of different targets summarized in this figure, which were to do with inequality, health, education, gender rights, health, and so on, and international programs. And they were very important because they were a statement of a commitment to address some of the long-standing questions about inequality across the world. But as was pointed out in the previous panel, some of the gains associated with the Millennium Development Goals have been those associated with those people who are already relatively well positioned in their respective societies. And the gains have been made by not those who are the most marginal within poor countries, but among those who are already relatively well positioned, either because of their location or their position in an income distribution or their position in a labour market, to access the improvements that governments use to target their achievement of the Millennium Development Goals. Those Millennium Development Goals have now been superseded as of the end of last year by the Sustainable Development Goals, which are a much broader, much more expansive set of commitments that include not just the commitments of low-income countries and international aid donors to helping the poorest in poor countries, but they are a global set of goals in which richer countries are also signing up to commit. And these goals are also interesting because instead of having a tendency, or the goal is not to choose the easily achievable measures of improvement with regard to access and equality, but rather to leave no one behind. And this is a major change in the politics of the inequality question, not least because the, so for example, paragraph 4 of the Transforming Our World, I'll just read this, as we embark on this great collective journey, we pledge that no one will be left behind. Recognizing that the dignity of the human person is fundamental, we wish to see the goals and targets met for all nations and peoples and for all segments of society. And we will endeavor to reach the furthest behind first. Okay, so the goal is to broaden the inclusionary agenda of the Sustainable Development Goals, and this has meant in turn that there is attention paid to the nature of inequalities. In the goals themselves, recognize that the most vulnerable and marginal are low, so often in income, they're also low in influence, and they're often low in well-being because of the social factors which compound their marginalization. And this has meant an increasing attention being paid to the need to take intersectional inequalities into account. And by that, we mean that the if you are both elderly and a woman, you have a worse position than if you were a woman or if you were an elderly person. Okay, so intersectional inequalities is addressing the way that multiple axes of inequality come together to qualitatively worsen the position of people at the bottom of those hierarchies. And the research, or the sort of theoretical framework for this, has come very much from a sort of black and post-colonial feminist perspective, but it is increasingly being seen as a way to understand the kind of policy challenges associated with achieving the Sustainable Development Goals. So what we have then at the global level is a real commitment to and an interest in trying to leave no one behind, and also a growing awareness of the need for policy to take intersectional inequalities into account. And I wanted to finish my talk by looking at the ways in which my research in Ecuador has addressed or found the difficulties that the Sustainable Development Goals might face in addressing those kinds of issues. This is the cover of my book, which came out in 2015, in which I traced over from the 70s the ways in which two groups of indigenous women have experienced the various policy measures associated with what I term single issue development, that is either sort of rural development or gender and development or ethno development for indigenous people. And that allowed me to explore the ways in which intersectional realities for these women are engaging or not, or reflected or not, in the policy frameworks with which they are being, into which they're being involved. So the findings, I just wanted to highlight three main findings of this research, because it highlights, I think, the challenges that the Sustainable Development Goals will face. The first is that development and public policy has often been organized around what I call single-issue development. In other words, one dimension of inequality has been considered at the cost of making invisible the intersecting influences on people and individuals in that group. So, for example, rural development not taking into account female-headed households, or gender and development not taking into account race and ethnicity. And it sounds very straightforward now, perhaps, but what I also have identified is the way that the awareness of those intersectional, cross-cutting factors behind inequality are in fact embedded within sort of colonial mindsets, which make the recognition of those intersectional inequalities very difficult to come to terms with and address. So the policy understandings of intersectional inequality that I looked at suggested that some of the criteria by which people, if they were approached or involved in a program, were more to do with what the agenda of the policymakers was than the wishes of the people who were to be included in a program. So to just give you an example, gender and development programs in Ecuador approached indigenous women as sort of people who didn't reach the standards and the quality of behavior and involvement in a number of different spheres that were associated with the majority ethnic group. And so that meant that they were more concerned about turning indigenous women into mestiza women, as they're called, than they were in thinking about the specific factors behind those indigenous women's position of inequality that they experience. And this that you may say, well, this is not related to colonial power, but it is related, according to how I trace through, I can show that the way in which those expectations and the articulation of policy agendas by some of the national policymakers in different spheres uses language which we know comes from the colonial era distinctions between women and men or between indigenous people and non-indigenous people. And the further point that I found was that if intersectionality is taken into account, that these tend to follow particular rules. In other words, that the policymakers have in their mind a very clear sense of what are the main agendas for pursuing, and intersectional agendas are often seen as add-ons, rather than as intrinsically important in understanding the inequalities experienced and lived through by particular marginal groups. So rather than ending on that rather negative point of view, I do think there's also some ways forward, some of which I do discuss in my final chapter of the book, which I'll come back to in a minute. First of all, I think that this suggests that there needs to be new ways of learning about and understanding inequalities, much more from the perspective of those who are experiencing those multiple intersecting patterns of exclusion and inequality, that there is the real need for more voices and diversity of perspectives to be brought forward, not least because the experiences of these groups are often little understood, but also because they can, in some cases, adopt very innovative measures themselves to try and tackle the difficulties that they face. The second step, I would say, which might be worth pursuing, is to think more at the national level. I think that many of the measures that need to be taken to tackle intersectional inequalities and the Leave No One Behind agenda are positioned at the level of national policy. And yet, we have little understanding of the ways in which policy thinking or policy structures engage with or succeed in tackling these intersectional inequalities. So there's been some initial work done on Ecuador, because Ecuador has introduced a new constitution and a variety of different legislative changes associated with trying to create equality with diversity. But we don't have comparative data or comparative research on how these different strategies, often very innovative, often unprecedented policy designs, are actually faring on the ground in terms of people's experience of substantive citizenship. So this is one thing that I'm pursuing myself going forward. But there's also work that can be done arguably at an international level, and that is with respect to looking at how different kinds of countries who are often in very different positions can address the Leave No One Behind agenda during the first 1,000 days. There's been arguments made by the Overseas Development Institute which suggest that unless action is taken immediately to start tackling these profound inequalities, that by 2030 there won't be the improvement in those indicators. So Elizabeth Stewart and others at the Overseas Development Institute have started to formulate and look at different approaches that might be used in post-conflict societies versus very unequal middle-income countries, for example, in order to adapt the Leave No One Behind agenda for individual circumstances among countries. So on that point, I'll finish. Thank you very much.